I will call this meeting of March 2nd of the Legacy Finance Division or Finance Committee to order, and don't quite have a quorum yet. I'm sure they'll be here eventually. So, start out with a couple things on the agenda. First of all, we'd had some questions previously, mainly from audience members, about AMPRS, on whether they, or not they have disability accessible provisions. I will read briefly, and if you have any comments or questions, we can go on with that. Regarding AMPRS on the issue of accessibility, they do not have any state or federal requirements that we know of that require them to have accessible websites. But they are, of course, interested in finding ways to make it more accessible. That's and then also, this is from AMPRS. As a result, we are exploring options to make our programs accessible to individuals with disabilities. We are gathering estimates, and if we are able to make the content accessible within our budget constraints, we will certainly do so. They say they'll make every effort possible to make all content so they create accessible to all Minnesotans, and it is the first time anyone has brought this to their attention. So once again, the Legacy Committee is trendsetters. Ms. Mullen, do you have anything to add on that?
Thank you, Chair Erdl. I don't have anything to add right now, but if I do get other responses from other organizations, I'll send them on to the committee.
Okay, thank you. And we thank the members of the audience who brought this to our attention to hopefully help to make this more accessible to them in the future. And now we have a quorum. Thank you, Ms. Quorum. So with that, I think we'll let Representative Murphy move the approval of the minutes of February 24th. If you look them over and
I was prepared before I came to the committee, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I move the minutes.
All right. Those in favor say aye. All right, we can do better than that. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Otherwise, thank you, Representative Heinzman.
No problem.
Well, our first item today is House File 967, Representative Baker. And approach the witness table, please. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be here today.
I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, I'd like to move House File 967.
Actually, we have to move it for you.
I'm sorry.
So Representative Torkelson is going to move this.
I would be happy to move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Do we have to move an amendment first? You have to move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment to House File 967 to get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Discussion on the amendment. Representative Baker, will you explain, please, what the amendment does?
One moment, please. Thank you. The amendment, it looks fine, Mr. Chair. Again, it looks like it states that for the reporting period, it relates to the grant of the Kajuk in the section so that it has jurisdiction under the legacy funding. So I'm approving this as presented.
Okay, thank you, Representative Baker. Any other discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. The bill is now in the state that the author wishes it, I believe. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Baker, you may present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am honored today to be here to present House File 967, kind of labeled as Kajug, which means stay away. This is an important bill that allows our Somali American communities to find ways to enact our communities in Minnesota, both metro and rural communities, so that our Somalian communities can participate in after-school activities, 4-H clubs, FFA, and there's a growing need to make sure that our youth in these communities are safe, are well maintained, and sort of integrated into all of our communities. And I think that visiting with the stakeholders here, we've got a lot of good opportunities around the state of Minnesota to find ways to engage our folks, and I have some folks here to testify, if I could, and I'll introduce the bill as such, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker.
Chairman, committee members, thank you so much for having us. My name is Mohammed Farah. I am the executive director of Kajok. I'm here with Hassan Warsameh, who is one of our students. Just a little bit about Kajok. In 2007, Kajok began with an idea and a vision to build a strong support network for Somali youth in Minnesota. Kajok is a Somali term for stay away. We work to urge Somali youth to stay away from all negative influences, including the recruitment of Al-Shabaab and ISIS by getting them engaged in education and the arts. Our mission is to focus youth toward higher education, build civic involvement, and volunteer commitment. Kajok received many awards over the past couple of years, including, but not limited to, the Somali American Community Appreciation Award from the elders and the community leaders, which led us to host the Somali Independence Day Festival, which brings over 20,000 people together. Because of our success of engaging young people in the Twin Cities, the idea of Kajok has been used by the international community to engage young people, most recently in Canada and Kenya. Kajok was also part of the delegation from Minnesota that went to the White House conference on countering violence extremism early this month with the U.S. Attorney Andy Luger, Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanick, and others. I would like to highlight a few of our programs. Our FUNCA Invisible Art Program is a cultural heritage and arts combined program. This is a program where young people are learning about their culture and heritage, and at the same time, we use the arts as a tool of engagement to empower, encourage, and provide opportunities for intercultural dialogue. Our Be at School is a truancy program focused in increasing school attendance and increasing early warning signs. Our Take Off is an after-school program that includes leadership building and hands-on learning. It also includes 4-H Club in partnership with the University of Minnesota. We also send a group of Somali girls to Yellowstone Park in partnership with Wilderness Inquiries, outdoor experiences tailored to leadership building, and we also have a Boy Scout troops. As a community at large, we know that radicalization or the recruitment of ISIS and Al-Shabaab doesn't happen overnight. It's definitely a process. There are many underlying issues that cause the vulnerability of a fellow American to be radicalized, such as the lack of education, lack of mentorship, guidance lack of mentorship and guidance, lack of unemployment and isolation. In order to address these recruitment, Kajok is in the forefront fighting this through the education and the arts. One of our plans for the next few years is to expand our FUNCA program. By the way, FUNCA is a Somali term, and it means the arts, throughout the state where we have a high population of Somalis. We will do this by partnering with many organizations, such as the Somali American Parent Association, Minnesota Humanities Center, BPS, Riverside Youth Council, and many others. Just to give you a picture of our current program and how it's running, the program is running in three different locations: Eden Prairie, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. It runs on a weekly basis. Teaching artists work with students for 8 weeks, and then they put on a public presentation that includes what they have learned. I will show you a video of a student. Her name is Asiya, and she's one of our students here in our St. Paul location.
Those labels that give me, I won't let define me. So let me clear up this perception, it's just a misconception. Yes, on that TV station, projecting my people all so wrong. For so long, it became their theme song. My name flying right and left them sick and tired of dodging haters, all it causing. I'm not a terrorist, I'm not. I can keep going, but I will tell you who I really am. I'll lower my gaze because that's humble and modesty, and that's how a Muslim girl should be.
And with me here is also Warsame, Hassan Warsame, who's also part of our arts program and most of our programs as well.
Thank you. Welcome and identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Hassan Warsame. I'm a sophomore at Eden Prairie High School. Just a little background about me. I play football for the best football team in the state of Minnesota.
Does that include the Vikings?
Yeah, debatable. I throw shot put in the spring and I wrestle in the winter. And seventh grade is where I met Muhammad Farah. He helped me, pretty much. Very misbehaved child, misunderstood, and I got to express myself, I got to talk to them, I found out, while I was doing so many bad things, because, I didn't have a leader, I didn't have people, teach me the way, the right path where I was going, and I went on, they taught me a lot of arts, we went on a trip to the Somali Museum out of Minneapolis on Lake Street, and took about 40 kids with us, 50 around there, and I learned about pretty much my background, my heritage, where I come from. So many things, forgotten language. I'm not really, 100%, fluent in Somali, but, I'm trying. And I went on a camp, Boy Scout camp, 2 summers ago with Kajug, and I learned a lot of things. First time I ever canoed, first time I ever went camping, learned how to make a tent, and just want to say thank you to Kajug and everything you guys done for me.
Thank you, and I will open for any questions to the committee members.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, and I've got just a couple of questions, and first one, maybe you don't have any way of answering, but do you have any idea how many young Somali are radicalized, if you will, and return to Somalia?
Well, we know that since 2008, Al-Shabaab has recruited well over 24 young men. And most recently, ISIS has been recruiting. It's been all over the news most recently within the last couple of months here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. And also, Mr. Pereira, you mentioned 3 basically Twin Cities areas. Now, I know that Representative Baker and I think Representative Daniels as well have significant Somali populations in their communities. Are you in this money that you are asking for planning on expanding to the rest of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. As a matter of fact, we do have 3 locations in the Twin Cities, but the expansion does include taking this program across the state where we have high populations of Somalis, such as Wilmer, Rochester, Mankato, and so forth. It does include across the state.
Any other questions for me? Yes, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers and Representative Baker. Thank you for bringing this forward, and just want to express an apology from Representative Kahn. She was unable to be here today. She had a loss in the family, and anyways, she just wanted to pass that on. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and this is probably a question for you and to the amendment. What is the annual grant reporting information that this committee requires in the proposals? Is there a standard that is used?
Well, thank you, Representative Murphy. I don't know, annual grant reporting, we require from each expenditure of money a report on how the money was used, so I guess that could include a grant report. And in this case, they're asking the Department of Administration to make the report. So this is a standard report that we do require.
And again, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm asking only because, you know, I'm a newbie on the committee. So as we move forward and make decisions about legacy funding, then we would anticipate that there would be reports coming back to the committee after implementation. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
That is correct, Representative Murphy. By the way, nice job on WCCO yesterday.
Hey, thanks so much.
Other questions? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Baker, and to the testifiers for having this bill and for the work that you're doing in education and educating our youth and getting them involved in these activities. And I think that's a great effort. But I did have a question, just looking at the spreadsheet here on the budget, as far as the line item about travel and transportation. And I was just wondering, just because legacy dollars are supposed to be specifically used in Minnesota, if you were to be able to get this appropriation, would you be making sure that those dollars are used in Minnesota, or how would that work?
Chairman, Representative, thank you so much for the question. All the dollars that you see before you will is definitely within the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Any closing comments, Representative Baker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank the committee for allowing us to hear this today. When I was back in our district in Kaneohe County, and again, we have a large community of Somalians that are very concerned about this. We have to, I think this bill sends a really good message to allowing our citizens to see that these great community members are working in Minnesota, especially in my district. They come here to raise their families, to get their children educated. It's a very good community we need to embrace. And I know that there's so much noise on the community that we all hear on the national level and the worldwide level. And I hope that Minnesota makes a strong statement today by making sure that we see the value of these youth and that their intentions are pure and good. And I think that the message has been so clouded out there by such horrible acts of violence that we need to make sure that we stand up for these good people in Minnesota. And I'm so proud to have so many of them in our community. And I'm just, again, glad that they were able to be here today. I'm proud to carry this bill. And I would hope that this bill has strong support in our committee in the House. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, Representative Baker. And I do thank and commend all of you for efforts that, in the long run, can help to make our world safer, not just our state. So with that, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our legacy omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, the next item is an overview of Wilderness Inquiry. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself and
sure, Mr.
sign
Chair,
in.
And members of the committee, my name is Greg Lace, and I'm the Executive Director and Founder of Wilderness Inquiry, a Minnesota nonprofit that's been connecting people to the outdoors since 1978. We're also proud partners with Kajug, I might add, and work with many people with disabilities in the outdoors. So we want to thank you for inviting us to talk about Minnesota's Youth Outdoors, an initiative that's designed to preserve Minnesota's outdoor heritage, enhance student academic achievement, and connect Minnesota's youth to their legacy of public lands. I know we all agree that Minnesota is an outdoor state with a rich history of outdoor pursuits and a fabulous system of public lands. Yet, as evidenced by a drop in many outdoor activities, our outdoor heritage is in danger of slipping away. We're also experiencing great disparities in student achievement, and we know that outdoor-based experiential education, whether in social studies, math, or science, can boost learning by engaging students in real-world, hands-on lessons. This is especially true with disadvantaged students who don't learn well in traditional classroom venues. Our intent is to provide meaningful outdoor learning opportunities for Minnesota students over the course of their K-12 education. Our plan with Minnesota Youth Outdoors is to scale up from reaching 15,000 students annually to 100,000 students annually, with an emphasis on underserved youth who currently don't have access to Minnesota's great outdoors. In Minnesota, we have built one of the best systems of public lands in the world. Now it's time to connect the system to students in our public schools and engage youth in their public lands legacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Dayton, and I am the Director of Partnerships and Programs at Wilderness Inquiry.
Welcome,
over the
Mr.
years,
Dayton.
With, pardon me?
I said welcome.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Over the years, and with the support of many, we've evolved a way of connecting schools to public lands that works and that is cost-effective. Our approach is to treat local public lands as an extension of a teacher's classroom, to get the kids there, and then help the teachers teach their regular curricula in a new and more engaging context, the real world. We call this the pyramid of engagement, and here's how it works. At this point, I draw your attention to the second page in the supplemental documents that were handed out, members of the committee. There is a graphic five-step pyramid of engagement. We began at the base of the pyramid. We call that introduction. This takes the form of half and full day experiences in local parks in conjunction with public schools. This augments learning in a variety of subjects and settings. These experiences at the introductory level of the pyramid can be made available to all students through public support as an integrated part of their school day. The second level of the pyramid we call engagement. These are overnight experiences in local parks with school-based outdoor clubs and community support. Students continue learning through deeper engagement and also experience the socio-emotional benefits of perseverance, shared responsibility, and collective accomplishment. The experiences at this level can be made available to students through a combination of public and private support. The third tier of the pyramid represents immersion. These are multi-day experiences in state and national parks where students plan and experience trips to places like Voyageurs National Park, Itasca State Park, or the Bluff Country on the Mississippi River. The experiences at this stage of the pyramid are primarily funded from private sources and/or fee-for-service. There are two other parts of the pyramid shown, post-secondary education and careers. These are natural outcomes of a more engaged K-12 student population and also a vital part of maintaining Minnesota's outdoor heritage. However, funding for these areas is, we believe, the responsibility of private employers and post-secondary educational institutions. In conclusion, Minnesota's Youth Outdoors is designed to engage and educate youth by making public lands relevant to their school experience in ways that help them learn more effectively. With the involvement of many partners in both the public and private sectors, we've built a framework, a system, and proven that it works. We are asking to partner with Legacy to scale up to introduce all Minnesota's youth to the outdoors, simultaneously preserving our heritage as an outdoor state, boosting student academic achievement, and connecting our youth to their legacy of public lands. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity. At this point, Greg and I are happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Dayton. Questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to know about gender balance in your programs in the past and what you seek to do have in the future. And I would also like to know what connection you have, if any, to community education programs in the schools. And I understand why you're asking in this ask for youth, because if you get them early and you get them often, then you'll get them forever. But there's a significant numbers of middle-aged people in Minnesota that have never had any opportunities like this at all. And I wonder how they can be involved in wilderness inquiry.
Mr. Lace, thank or Mr. Dayton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. First, to the question of gender balance, our programs and organization reflect the, you know, the population at large. It's roughly 50-50 in terms of the male-female ratios and everything that we do. If we have, so, you know, a lot of the kids come from the school district, so it would be, I think, a very, very balanced equation there. And certainly among our trail staff and other people, it's an equal mix of men and women. As far as how can middle-aged people participate, I'm glad that you brought that up, because part of our formula, although we're not talking about it here as much, is for family engagement, to get families and parents of kids and students involved. And we actually have quite a few programs for families to do just that. And, the other one was community education. Mm-hmm. You know what, we work with a wide variety of groups out there. Basically, anybody that wants to get outdoors, we work with them. We've met with people from, you know, Minneapolis Public Schools, community education, and other community education organizations. We've done different trips, but I wouldn't say that that's a well-developed pipeline that we have now, although we'd be happy to do that. I'm not sure if that answers all your questions, but...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy?
Could... Not right now, but could you provide some information to us on who the founders or the board of directors or whatever of your group is, and the diversity of the staff that you have working with you, and how many people you have working within your organization? And your answer to my question seemed to be, if the public school has a balance, or if the school districts that you're working with have a balance, then you'll have a balance. But do you do any outreach to make sure that underserved people, underserved girls, underserved boys, underserved certain disabilities, really are contacted to become part of your programs? Could you give us some background on that, if you have it, in the future?
Mr. Lace.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we would be happy to do that and provide you with the information on our staff and our board, and also our outreach and community efforts.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments, questions from members? Well, then, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yep. And the next item on the agenda, a overview of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council Fund. Welcome, Mr. Anderson, or Johnson, Scandinavians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Thank you for having me here today, and we'll give a quick overview today for you of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. There's a handout in your packet, which I'll be displaying on the PowerPoint. I'll try to go through that quickly for you. The Clean Water Land Legacy Amendment is what funds the Outdoor Heritage Funds, and as you may remember, it was ratified back in 2008. It was basically adding 3/8 of 1% sales tax onto the state sales tax, and that those proceeds of that were dedicated into four different accounts. One of those is the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which receives 33% of that total of the proceeds. Comes to about $100 million a year. And those funds are required by the Outdoor Heritage Fund to be used for protecting, restoring, and enhancing wetlands, forests, prairies, and habitat for game, fish, and wildlife, as well as a couple of other things, such as preventing forest fragmentation and parcelization. At least 99% of those funds have to be used for this purpose. The Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council was formed under Minnesota Statute 97.856, and the council is actually part of the legislative branch. That's what I'm trying to say. The council makes recommendations only to the legislature for appropriation, and the legislature decides if those recommendations are appropriate. The statute also requires for a small grant that is called the Conservation Partner Legacy Grants, and that is actually administered by the DNR. Those are for grants that are under $400,000, or actually up to, and that other grants that are done by the council itself are above $400,000. The makeup of the council itself is 12 members, 4 from the legislature, and 8 from the citizenry of Minnesota. Those are appointed, as you can see in this schematic, by the House of Representatives, the Senate, and of course the governor. The most recent appointments to that are Representative Dill, Barry Tilley, Julie Blackburn, and also Ron Scherer was reappointed to a second term. The statewide vision and priorities, of course, really round up to 3 different things: accountability, conservation focus, and also science-based. From the beginning, the guiding principles for the Outdoor Heritage Fund were established through a collaborative of not just the council, but also legislators and stakeholders, and those stakeholders also including agencies. The vision is really big picture approach, taking that 10,000-foot level view of things, and in a nutshell, the council within its recommendations, the council takes to heart the different things to look at, but really large programmatic-oriented endeavors that are well thought out, well designed, of high value to fish, wildlife, and habitat, have long-term impact and long-term benefit for future generations in Minnesota. Recipients, this chart shows you a quick overview of the recipients over the last 6 fiscal appropriations by the legislature and the last 6 recommendations from the council. This is the type of recipients just blocked out. The list at the bottom is just a short list of the recipients that there are.
Mr. Johnson, regarding that, I'm going to ask a couple questions that I get asked every now and then. Are they always the same that are getting the funding? I mean, I know, like, let's say Ducks Unlimited, I'm sure they probably get money every year. Are there different recipients that are added?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very good question. There are different recipients each year. Some are the same. As I mentioned a little bit ago, the council tries to take a programmatic look at projects as they come in. They really want to see projects that are going to be overarching, that aren't necessarily just a rifle that picks off one thing in one year. They'd rather see that where it's a very much of a program approach that's going to take a broader perspective, and that's why we have different phases that are each year, which you'll see in the bill when that comes before this committee. There will be phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and so on. But each year, the council also looks at those other new projects that come forward. And each year, there are about twice as many projects as there is funding. So in other words, if we have $100 million in funding available, there will be $200 million in appropriations requested within those projects. This current year, the number of projects that came in, I believe, was about 46 different requests for funding. Of those, I think there are 39, is that correct, in the upcoming bill.
Okay, thank you. Another question that's asked, some of the DNR as well, but Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, money is appropriated to those groups. They may make land purchases, they may do easements or other type expenditures. Why do you go through them and not just do it yourself?
Mr. Chair, another very good question. I doubt I'll answer this adequately, but I will try. Remember, I'm new to the position. My understanding is that the councilor really, as well as the legislature, have wanted to engage the public as much as possible in utilizing these funds and putting them to work on the ground. Because of that, the groups are able to provide a different interaction with the public, for one thing, but also they bring some extra expertise and outreach into the communities as they come forward with the projects. When the groups are involved, such as Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, whoever, almost always agencies are involved with that, or government entities, such as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the governmental oversight and expertise is still involved as the public entities, or the, maybe I should say, the nonprofit and the local entities are involved as well. I hope that answered your question, sir.
Thank you. That helps out. Continue.
This next slide, I think it's the bottom of page 3 for your handout. Actually, I think we just went over that one, so we'll jump to the next one on 4. This is just this graphic provides a background of the 6 years of appropriations, again, for just the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. So you can see how the appropriation amounts came through. Last year, please notice that it went from the normal $4 million up to over $8 million. That's because half of that, roughly, was dedicated for the 7-county metro and cities of populations of 50,000 or greater. The CPL this year, I think in this upcoming bill, is about $8,440,000. Again, some very good projects coming in from that. The list at the right is, again, simply an example of some of the multitude of recipients of that. And I should say that most of the grants, remember, CPL grants are up to $400,000. Most of the grants are under $50,000, and I believe most of them are actually under $25,000 in amount. So those dollars spreading in those small amounts really scatter throughout the state. The council, in the very beginning, went ahead and worked with professionals within the resource field as agencies and stakeholders look at the ecological sections within the state and broke this out. It broke out into 5 areas with which all the projects are set. You can see the upper right, the pinkish purplish is the northern forest. I'm sorry you can't read the legend necessarily. The yellow is the forest prairie transition. The darker shaded, of course, around the metro area here is the metro urbanized, that darker shaded blue. Southeast Minnesota is the pinkish orange one, and that's the southeast forest. And the prairie region is the blue along the western, central, and southern sides of the state. Real quickly, across those different sections, in the northern forest section, here's a few examples. The picture at the right really is of a 13-acre parcel on Burnside Lake in St. Louis County. The OHF, or Outdoor Heritage Funds, were used by the Minnesota Land Trust to purchase a conservation easement on this and 9 other parcels near this property on Burnside. Very pristine lands with unique habitat that now are permanently protected in perpetuity, but privately owned still, and still on the tax rolls. Northern Forest section outcomes are listed here for your interest. Maybe you may want to read those later or read them now, whichever you prefer. But the larger goal really is each of the outcomes have outputs. In other words, how many acres are enhanced or restored for habitat, how many miles of stream are restored or protected, etc., number of trees planted, and so on. But the outcomes are much larger, and really that's what the council tries to concentrate on, or what are the larger outcomes, as you can see here. What is the improved aquatic habitat? What's the access or management to public lands, etc.? Programs funded in the forest and prairie transition area. These are just some examples. Again, in that lower right-hand corner is Gilfillan Lake. It's a new wildlife management area that was purchased near Madison Lake in Blue Earth County. Ducks Unlimited and the DNR were collaborators on this project in the acquisition and restoration In this case, you don't see any water because it was during the two-year drawdown that, in this case, allows for those native vegetation to come up to dig their roots in deeper and to revive. And again, the outcomes for the prairie and forest transition areas, you can see the outcomes are varied due to the tremendous diversity and as those habitats intermingle. The metro urbanized section is, again, a list of just a few of them. This list could be quite a bit larger and is ever increasing, but none of the these are all the large grants that are over 400,000, or these are some of the large grants over 400,000 in amount. There are a ton of them that are small grants, again, through the CPL happening in the metro and urbanized area. Here again is just the outcomes. This photo in particular came from the Anoka County Parks and Recreation. It's courtesy of them. What looks like a rolling field of small grain is pretty much what it is right at that point. But it's part of the restoration project to help gain control of the soil and vegetation. In this case, it was a field of rye, or rye was put on as a cover crop. Well, that is one of the portions of the process of restoring this to prairies and with native grasses and to wetlands as a complex.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Do you have a breakdown of funding by section, percentage?
We do, sir. And Mr. Chairman, we do, sir, and we'll get to that in just a moment. It's on one of the other graphs. If it's not detailed enough, I will certainly get more for you.
All right. Thank you.
This next is with the Southeast Forest section. Again, a short list. This photo is, it looks like two totally different areas. It's not. It's quite dramatic in what they were able to do with respect to what Minnesota Trout Unlimited, or Trout Unlimited, I'm sorry, was able to do with regards to this trout stream. It's actually Hay Creek, which is notorious for trout. It's a great trout creek. If you've ever been there, it's a phenomenal area and beautiful topography. You can kind of see it. In the lower picture in the left-hand side, there's a blue, sort of blue, outhouse. That's actually in the upper picture, too. It's just a hair to the left behind the brush. So it's quite a dramatic difference between what they do. The one interesting thing to point out here is that with the aquatic habitat improvements that were done on this, the increase and the sustainability in trout populations was increased many, many fold. In the Southeast Forest section, outcomes again are listed here, but high on the challenges in that area are protecting the forest fragmentation parcelization, protecting the few remaining rare goat prairies down there, and also protecting, restoring, and enhancing the cold water fisheries. The prairie section, again, a few of the examples of some of the larger projects that have happened out in the prairie region, prairie section. The photo at the right is the Landfield Prairie. It's a beautiful piece of native prairie. It was the first fee title purchase of land in Clay County with Outdoor Heritage Funds. It had been pasture land owned by the Landfield family, and it was purchased by the Nature Conservancy with Outdoor Heritage monies to be preserved in its natural state as native prairie. Native prairies used to cover much of central, southern, and western Minnesota. As I've been told, they now are a remnant of about 1% of the landscape. Again, the list of outcomes for the prairie section. Here again, you'll notice keeping water on the land is one of the outcomes. It's the last one listed. It may seem to be a simplistic goal, but the benefits to wildlife of all types, as well as the clean water, can't be overstated by that one simple outcome. Here's a list of the council recommendations to date. This is just starting into a few of these. As you can see, there's been some changes as we move through the years and slightly increasing. Of course, that's dependent upon sales tax receipts. Acres affected by activity. And after a little bit, Mr. Chair, we'll have acres affected as well as funding affected from an ecotype or eco-section area. I would draw your attention to the 2009 column as easement, and you'll see that acreage is quite high. This is mostly due to an incredible conservation easement purchase of with the Outdoor Heritage Funds of Bland and Paper Corporation lands near Grand Rapids. There was about 180,000 acres in that one swift, one fell swoop of that easement, which is some incredible lands that now are protected in perpetuity for as working forests and protected from public use in perpetuity as well. Another thing that to note is the figures in this and the following charts are ever changing as projects are completed. For those of you who served on the Environment Committee, you maybe saw you may have seen some charts similar to these. These numbers here should be higher slightly because they're ever increasing and ever changing. These were updated last Friday. Here we have the funds recommended by activity, and these were also appropriated by, as they fell into the different activity areas. And then we get into the effect by section, by ecosection. So these are the acres affected by ecosection. Just to let you know that this chart and the next one are not filled in completely. As you'll see, the ML 2009 says NA. The reason for that is just simply because in that very first year, Outdoor Heritage Projects had no requirement for reporting by ecosection. That subsequently was changed, and those numbers are being picked up and accumulated along with everything else as the appropriations finalize and as the all of the 2009s are finalized, then they'll all be added and added in. Here is the funding recommendations by ecosection, as you can see how they break out. And that is, again, 2009, I mentioned they will be picked up. They just weren't required to be reported by ecosection. Are those what you're looking for, those two, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And, you know, I was aware of that. I'd gone through this previously, but what I was looking for was a percentage. I like percentages. And, you know, I suppose I could have my committee administrator sit down with his calculator and figure this out, too. He doesn't have much to do anyway.
Mr. Chair, we can help you with that, and we can provide that.
All right, well, thank you. That'll relieve Gavin.
Okay.
Representative Green, did you have a question? Ooh.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have to leave in a couple minutes, so I'd like to get a couple of questions in. I was going to wait until he finishes, but I might not. Pardon me?
We'd be disappointed if you didn't have time to get your questions in.
I knew that you would. Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, I'll just refer back to these. You don't have to go back, but maybe if you get me some information. When the money goes to the organizations such as, because I'm not on the page, I'll just refer them off the top of my head, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Trouts for Unlimited. Do you have a list of how much land they have purchased and how much, what percentage of Outdoor Heritage funds went to those purchases and what percentage was from other private donations? And then the amount that they paid for the property per acre, as opposed to what the value of it is?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, if I can phone a friend and have Heather come up, Heather Coop, my assistant director. In the meantime, while she's walking up, we do have, I believe, most, if not all, of that information, and we can put that together for you, sir. And with that, I'm going to let Heather let us know if we have all of the information.
Thank you. Identify yourself, please.
Heather Coop, Assistant Director for the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council.
Welcome, Ms. Coop.
Thank you. Chair Erdahl, Representative Green, we do have that information available. Each piece of land that is acquired with Outdoor Heritage Fund is required to submit what we call an initial land reporting form. And that land reporting form entails all kinds of really helpful information. It tells us what the assessed value is of the parcel. It tells us what the appraised value is. It documents all the other funds that might have gone into that acquisition, if there are any. Sometimes there are, sometimes there's not. It also requires that each recipient of funds attest to the fact that notice the funding restriction has been placed on the land. We require some parcel geometry so that we can map the acquisitions, and a variety of other documents too. If there's a restoration and management plan, we also have that. If there's a conservation easement, we have copies of those as well. So we try as best we can to document the entire purchase in one online reporting form that is accessible to the public as well, because it is obviously all public information.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Green?
And thank you for that. And if you could shoot me an email with the links to those, that would probably save a lot of time. The other is a pretty simple question. Back on page 8 of the handout, what time of year were those pictures taken?
Pardon me, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Green. The top picture was taken in the fall or the very early spring. I don't know which, but definitely after or before greenup. I believe it was in the very early spring before greenup. And the bottom picture, of course, you can see it would be somewhere in the neighborhood, and I can't tell you exactly. These were provided by the project manager with Trout Unlimited, and John Leschewski, I think is his correct pronunciation of his last name. So that would have been in the late spring, early summer.
Okay. One more.
Representative Green.
I have got a lot of copies of legislative auditors' reports on legacy funds, and I did not bring them with today because I wouldn't have time to go into them anyway. But are you aware of these reports and on the violations that were in there? Have you, got as the Lessard Stamps Council, gone back and taken care of those violations in that report?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, if it's okay, I'd like to defer to Ms. Koop for that, being I have just took the position here this fall.
It's fine.
Ms. Koop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I'm not sure which report of which you speak. There have been a number of OLA reports, but most of those reports have focused on the recipients and not on the council. My understanding is that the majority of those issues have been resolved through the Department of Natural Resources or the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which are the two pass-through agencies that we use for these appropriations. If there's a specific question on one of the issues raised, I'd be more than happy to do the research and find that for you. But my understanding is that the council itself had not had any findings in any of the OLA reports.
Representative Green.
Then, Mr. Chair, just thank you, and thank you for that information. Maybe you can contact my office, and maybe we can get that information so I can have that with me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Koop. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Johnson, a couple of areas I'd like to cover, at least briefly. First, are there restrictions on the land that you purchase in fee? Are there restrictions as to the activities that can occur on that land after it's been purchased?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Darkelson, yes, there are, depending on the type of are you talking about fee title acquisition, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Darkelson, for fee title acquisition, by statute, those properties, unless otherwise prescribed by law, must be open to the public for hunting and fishing. With respect to the types of activities, otherwise the restoration activities and so on that happen on those properties, it really depends on what the end use is for them. If it's a WMA, a wildlife management area, or a wildlife production area, of course, then it's open to public hunting and fishing. If there are lands that are purchased and handed over to the National Refuge system, then those are managed under the refuge system itself and its management plan, and those properties always have generally limited, or if not full, open hunting and fishing public use. For other restrictions, Ms. Koop, am I forgetting something? Anything?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we've had some purchases that have gone into other hands, and I'm not sure if I'm describing that correctly, but ended up in ownership of other entities, and in that case, do those restrictions carry forward to the other entities?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, they do. In fact, Ms. Koop mentioned a little bit ago the notice of funding restriction that follows each property that's acquired. That's placed on the deed of the property, and the notice of funding restriction makes sure that those caveats, those restrictions for use or maybe say the requirement for public use, continue forward. In the what you may be referring to is some properties have been acquired with Outdoor Heritage funds, and they're being held in ownership by the Nature Conservancy. In that case, Nature Conservancy has to follow that notice of funding restriction. Those lands are open for public use, and in those cases also Nature Conservancy is paying the taxes on this property. When I thought of another example too, last year there was the Fond du Lac tribal project. They are I don't believe it's not closed yet by any means. They're still in the process of defining and acquiring the properties, but even in that case those properties will be open to public use. There was a restriction, I think, of one restriction that was approved which has to be approved by the commissioner, and I believe was signed out to, and that would be the restriction of wolf hunting on those properties.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the project I'm really trying to drill down into is the Mississippi Northwoods project. I understand there's potentially going to be some trail development on that property that doesn't seem to fit with council restrictions. Can you please describe that process?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes. Actually, that it will be a topic of discussion at our March 13th meeting for the council. The county has been asked, Crow Wing County has been asked to come down and make a presentation to us, give us an update on where that all stands. The what's happening in that case, just what I know at this point, sir, is that the Crow Wing County has received an application from a local ATV club asking for backup. Mississippi Northwoods was a property of about, it was $11 million and about 2,000 acres, I think. That was acquired along the Mississippi, quite an extensive amount of Mississippi shoreline between Brainerd and the Crosby-Ironton. The property is very scenic, and it was owned by Potlatch previously. Potlatch was looking to divest and was looking at subdividing that property. It was purchased as a whole to be kept in basically in continuity with the habitat, protect the habitat and the scenic shoreline, etc. As part of the workings of the project, the land actually, once it was purchased, went into ownership with the county of Crow Wing, and part of that reason was to keep PILT, or the payment in lieu of tax requirement, down, so the state wasn't liable for the PILT on those acres. County is to keep those properties in working forest, that's part, and they're to be managed underneath their forest and recreational management plan. One of the very pointed discussions of that was about a paved trail going through the property. Information put into the appropriation work plan or the accomplishment plan delineating what could and could not be done. At this point, the county has received an application for a trail, as I mentioned, from an ATV group. And they're processing that. They've gone through step one. I think they're entering step two, which means they've received the application. Now they're looking at it to decide if it's appropriate for the area or not. That's the information beyond that, or the information beyond that is what we hope to gain on the 13th. And the council definitely has feelings on that. As you may remember, there was quite some conversation a year ago, or more than a year ago, about the trails on that, potential trails on that property.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So will the council have final authority on whether those trails can or cannot be built on that property?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I guess the wisest thing for me to say is that it has yet to be determined. We're talking with legal staff from House and Senate, also looking at the accomplishment plan, and again we'll be discussing it with the county as it moves forward. I can't give you a determination at this point, sir.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I realize this occurred before your tenure and in your current position, but it certainly sends up a red flag in my mind that as we move forward with these purchases that we properly address those restrictions in a way that where we know who's in charge and what those are. This leads me to the question of PILT or PILT-like funding. When we purchase lands and take them off the local tax rolls, certainly we push the burden of property taxes on other property owners in that particularly property tax district. Has the council been looking at this issue in any? I realized in this case of Mississippi Northwoods, the idea was to kind of, well, we'll give it to the county and then we're off the hook for PILT because the county is the owner of the land. That apparently didn't work out all that well, at least from my perspective. Has the council been talking about other ways to address this very important issue?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I'll start, and if Ms. Koop has more to add to this, she may be able to fill in some other pieces as well because of her historical knowledge of this. To my understanding, the council has been discussing it. One of their biggest concerns is really the constitutionality of spending outdoor heritage funds on a payment in lieu of tax. In other words, is it legal or is it constitutionally all right to constitutionally legal to spend tax monies to pay taxes or to pay a tax liability? So it is a constant conversation, I believe, of the council. I know this year it's a conversation within the legislature again to probably a greater degree than it has been in the past. And you all will probably have much more to say in that than myself or maybe the council as well. Probably most likely more than the council. Ms. Koop, do you have anything further to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson.
Ms. Koop.
Thank you. The only thing I would add is that in the early days, I think 2009 or 2008, and perhaps Ms. Taylor can correct me, but there was a letter written to the Attorney General's office asking for an opinion on whether the Outdoor Heritage Funds could be used to pay payment in lieu of taxes. The Attorney General's office declined to issue a ruling, if you will, or an opinion, but they did indicate in a letter to the council that it, in their view, there was potential for problems if the PILT were used for other expenses outside of the maintenance of the lands acquired, restored, or enhanced. So, for example, PILT is often given to or sent to the counties for disbursement to cities, townships, and other local units of government, and should those other units of government use those funds for, say, ambulance service or other kind of public service, it would raise the constitutionality of the protect, restore, and enhance confines of the purpose of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So, frankly, we don't know. We have that piece of information to go on. But again, as Mr. Johnson indicated, it's clearly within the legislature's purview to make a recommendation on whether Outdoor Heritage Funds can be used or not.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is a very important question. As the council seems to be actively pursuing land purchases as we speak, and without knowing the answer to this question, we're certainly adding a burden to the state to maintain these lands, at the same time as we are removing tax revenue from our local jurisdictions. And the problem is growing. I think it's critical that the council address this issue clearly and effectively and come to the legislature with their ideas on how we can address this very important topic. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director.
Representative Torkelson? Oh, okay. And Representative Torkelson was raising, you know, some very legitimate concerns that, you know, this committee has and others on the land acquisition and the PILT payments and taking all the tax rolls, so we certainly would appreciate your looking into that. Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Johnson, I'm going to be as careful as I can. I could be treading on some thin ice on this particular issue and some of the questions that I have. Of course, the project that we were just discussing is in my district. And there's been some controversy, as mentioned. But I would like to, I guess, put a little bit of a positive perspective in the mix on this particular issue. I think that it is important that we recognize on some level that on a project like this one, motorized vehicle use was a traditional use. There's been people on that property using motorized vehicles for nearly 60 years. And I'm not sure how the cards will all fall on this particular discussion, but I do think that as we see outdoor recreation changing in Minnesota, for example, out in Cuyuna, we have fat bikes cruising down the hills in the winter. You know, who would have guessed we'd have been doing things like that? I guess maybe you could consider that a change of a sort. So I guess I'm trying to lay out sort of my concern that we would be afraid of looking at new, maybe some new ideas in the future, or maybe in the context of the Mississippi project in my county. There are a lot of folks that view the proposals that the county has prepared as a very positive move for our county in terms of that project, and I like that it's going to be the proposal includes a lot of shared uses, so there's a lot of groups that are going to be able to continue to use potentially and then add to that property and that project. So I guess if there's a question, the question would be, is there a way forward that keeps the Outdoor Heritage Council out of hot water, yet at the same time trying to maybe look towards the future and preserving things that might not always in the context of outdoor or uses. Maybe it isn't traditional in some people's mind, but of course, a guy like me, that's something that I grew up with and something that my family has grown up with for a long time, that motorized use.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heisman, thank you for that. It's definitely things change. Time changes everything. One of the concerns of the council, probably the underlying concern amongst everything else, is the looking at the vision for that or the intent of that appropriation. And that's what will be part of their discussion on the 13th at their council meeting. And the intent for that parcel was habitat protection, enhancement, and restoration. Habitat for multiple game species. Within the use of the funds, the constitutional mandate is for, again, the protection, enhancement, and restoration of habitats. So that's why the council, I think that's maybe at the seat of why the council is concerned about the trails issue. And I don't know how much more I can elaborate on that, because it's what's going to happen with the council and where their discussion will go. I don't know. I just know it is very primary on the agenda for the 13th, sir. And I'm sure the council will be looking at other things.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Johnson. So in a quick follow-up to that, on our 78 acres in the Nisswa area, my family maintains nearly 5 miles of trail. And I hope that as a part of that discussion that you just mentioned, there could be a reasonable context for that in the idea that trails can be an important benefit to wildlife and then also the access to those properties. So I hope that is a part of the discussion.
Mr. Johnson, any comment to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heisman, no further comment on that. I do have two more slides if you'd like, sir.
Let's do the next two slides, and then we'll go to Representative Lilly and Representative Murphy. Okay.
Just to, not to belabor these, just to let you know where you can find more resources about the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and the Outdoor Heritage Fund expenditures, our website, which is listed on this. Also, just down about halfway down or a little further, just above statutory authority, you see it says map. And if you drill into that, if you click on that, it brings you to a map like this. Each of these balloons has number on it depicting the number of projects that are finalized, that have been done within the vicinity of those bullets or those balloons. So you can click on those and drill down further to get to the actual each individual appropriation and even to their accomplishment plan if you'd like. And then, of course, there's the pardon me, it was three slides. Then there's also the LCC's legacy website, which is, here's the listing for that. You can look up not just Outdoor Heritage Funds, but parks, arts, trails, the clean water, the whole thing with that.
So. Okay, thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Johnson. Congratulations. You seem to be doing a good job of hitting the ground running on the leading the force. I have to say you're pretty lucky. I really have the utmost respect for Ms. Coop and I see Ms. Smith out there as well. You have a pretty able staff that are a great treasure, and I'm sure you've realized that already. Going back, stepping back to the Northwoods project, I was really happy to hear Representative Heisman just kind of with the positive spin, because that's what I took away from it. His predecessor, Representative Ward, really worked hard on that, and I'm glad you're embracing it as well, because it's my 2 years on that committee. I take that as being one of the treasures in Minnesota that we were able to preserve, and I know it's complicated, and many things that we do in this building are complicated and working out the details, but as a Minnesotan, I'm glad that's preserved. I'm glad it's, you know, yeah, we're going to have some trouble, we're going to have to figure it out, but having been on that land and just seeing what it is right out of Brainerd, and, you know, at the time when we're, you know, this is, granted, this is a political building, but a lot of people were saying, oh, there's an airport there. Oh, there's a dump there. But I'm telling you, you get in that land, and it's like you're in a different place. And it was, we were out there that day, I remember. She's pretty tough. But it was a cold day. I don't know if you guys were there, too. But it's an amazing place. Hills, so I can see the appeal. For multiple use, but what we're able to do as a state to preserve that forever, just simply by preserving the shoreline, to me, in my mind, having that preserved forever is, you know, yeah, the internal land's going to be tricky and how we work that out. I challenge the folks in your committee as when you bring this back to consider that Minnesotans are changing, some of what the representative mentioned as far as use, but they're also changing with expectations with health changes. You know, we have folks that might want to get on the land that want to hunt. And, well, you know, there's some amazing devices now that they can use, whether it's an ATV or a mobilized wheelchair or something, and to get in there. And I hope your members, which is a pretty amazing citizen group, I think, in my mind. I mean, you've got like the likes of like a Ron Shearer giving of his time and others from all over the state. It's a pretty amazing group. But I challenge them to think beyond the traditional hunter and realize that people are coming back maybe from Iraq, might be missing some pieces or something, and might need some other equipment. I remember Representative Creasel and what he was able to do on his motorized hunting device and get out there with his kids, you know, who are able-bodied, but he's able to share the experience of hunting. I mean, what's that worth? So I challenge you to look beyond, and that's kind of what the representative from the area is talking about. But I hold no shame in figuring out and that we acquired that land. I'm sorry I went on, but I just think it was amazing. So, Otis, you mentioned LaSalle Lake and some other projects, and if you can, on a lighter note, when you drain off a lake, if you could send that water to Wiper Lake, we'd appreciate it. When you're creating more duck habitat, we can use it. And then going on to the metro urban thing, and I challenge you to, when you're looking at it, I know the metro number is, I noticed it, it's a little bit bigger than it's been in some years. But I think you need to look at maybe like Representative Murphy's district and some of the more, I know the urban chart on your thing is pretty big. So there's quite a bit of difference between rural in my mind, Dakota County, or even the county that I represent, part of Washington County, to parts of Ramsey County or Hennepin. So just, I challenge you to figure out our future hunters and fishers that are, we could create as a state, and then, you know, they're going to go out and hunt and fish in other parts of the state. So anyways, that's kind of that. And then I was just kind of wondering if you had a comment on, you know, it's always kind of an ongoing debate, and I know in another committee they tweaked your proposals, and I wonder if you have an opinion as far as the tweaking that's occurred this year. And and I'm not pulling, I know our side did it in the past a little, and anyways, I'm just curious what do you feel. Do you have a sense of the governor's opinion on it as well, or I guess I'll stand. There may be a follow-up, too.
Thank you, Reverend Lilly, and Mr. Johnson, if you could keep your response fairly short on this, because you will be coming up again to present the bill, and at that point I think we'll get into that maybe a little bit more detail.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly, basically, in a nutshell, the council really feels that, and it has for years, it requests that its recommendations be considered as the whole and received as the whole. I believe the stakeholders have also been reiterating that in the press and so on. I cannot speak for the governor, and I don't have a position, sir.
Okay, thank you. Representative Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lilly kind of laid the groundwork for my questions and comments. I understand the importance of the council, but I also, when you were on slide 2, you talked about the Constitution and the role of the legislature, but even after all these years now, it doesn't seem to me that the legislature has an avenue to get in on the front end, and as a result we've tried on the back end, and that's always created a little problem. Representative Lilly used the word tweak, but it's much more than a tweak, because the Constitution says, and you say, that the council is part of the legislative branch. But how does the legislature as a whole, except for their representatives that are appointed by the speaker or the majority leader, how does a legislature get in early enough so they might be able to influence? Has the council talked about that, other than no, and oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about, or let some news articles go out to say that they have no business entering our business kind of thing? It seems to be easing off some, but is that because the legislature doesn't try anymore? Or is there some avenue that's open to the legislature more at the beginning than when the list comes through?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for that. Those questions. I'll try to answer them. There are two basic areas where I think the council or the legislature maybe underestimates its access to the council, and one is through the four legislators who sit on the council. The other, and those people are very important, and then when they bring in a legislative view to the council. I think it's very well received by all members. Maybe some of the reason in the past for some of the dissonance within the council, within their deliberations, has really been just because people are trying to figure out how do we all get our input made. The second area, though, that is, I think the legislators often underestimate their input, is with your own personal testimony or letter to the council that will be submitted to the entire council. I think that every legislator has a very extremely important voice, and the council definitely is not opposed to hearing those voices at all. In fact, every council member that I've spoken with really appreciates hearing from legislators exactly what they think.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, have you heard, you've been a stakeholder and you've worn the hat of someone that's been pleased with the results of the list, and you've been wearing the hat of someone that's not so pleased with the results of the list, but and now you're director, so you have all kinds of power now, huh? Mr. Johnson, has there been a discussion with the council and the stakeholders about what's going to happen in 2033?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, there has not been a discussion per se between the council and the stakeholders. However, there has been, as you may have been aware, about a month ago there was an anniversary, kind of a celebration of the Legacy Act and the accomplishments made thus far. And there was discussion around that. There was presentations and so on of what was happening. I don't think that was more, that really was more about what has taken place so far rather than what's going to take place as we move forward. I know that stakeholders are already, some of them are already thinking about what should we do in 2034, the arts community as well as the clean water community as well as the sportsmen, wondering to what should we be working forward, what should we be working towards, and when should that work start. That's not in my, anything that I've heard I'm supposed to be working on at this time. Thank you for bringing up the point that I've had a previous hat on before, and I must say that's my previous hat. As you mentioned, it's a whole different hat now with a lot more headaches, but I'm really proud to be in it. And I should say, too, that the staff that I've inherited is a wonderful staff, Ms. Coop, Ms. Smith, and Ms. Brazee, wonderful people to work with. So.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, I'd like to get on to Clean Water Council by 2 o'clock. Mr. Johnson will be up again testifying to the bill, so some of these questions could you keep in mind and bring up then? I've got one more question here on the list for Representative Miller, and then we'll move on to Clean Water Council. Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The pressure's on. I hope I'm brief here. Mr. Johnson, thank you very much. Ms. Coop, thank you. On your acres affected by LSOHC section, so that slide where you have kind of the numbers broken down by the different areas, are those, when you say acres affected, are those acres that are purchased, are those acres that are, some are purchased, some are not? What's kind of the breakdown? I'm trying to arrive at purchased acres through this program. Yeah, I don't have a number, I apologize. But it says acres affected by LSOHC. It's about, I will call it about the middle of the presentation.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, those actually are acres that, as you see on the left side of that, they're the protected acres are fee and easement. Those are either protected by acquisition of the land or acquisition of a conservation easement upon those lands.
Sure.
And that's how that breaks down. And then, of course, restore and enhance are down below that. And that's by each year, each official. Each
okay. Just a couple more quick questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller?
We'll be done before 2, I promise. Is there kind of like a a master plan? Is there an end goal with how many acres are projected or expected that are going to be put into some of these different programs through your organization? So I'm in a prairie area, so I'll keep it, you know, just I just look at that and I see 196,910 acres that are put into the program so far. Is there an estimation that when you've achieved all your goals, you can expect X number of acres to probably be under the program? Is there at all any sort of numbers like that?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, no, there are not numbers at this point. As I don't know if those if there will be numbers set in those goals as we move forward or not.
Okay.
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, are there funds that are allocated for the continued stewardship of these lands, or is it just kind of they are cleaned up? And I know there's lots of different programs, so it's kind of hard to encapsulate it all. But there's, you know, this is land, so the trees that I saw pulled out of some of the creeks, there's going to be new trees 10 years from now or something like that. Are there any funds that are planned or allocated towards the future preservation of these lands that are taken into public holding?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, no, there are not. The only funds that are appropriated forward that would be in these are actually for conservation easements, where it's for monitoring and enforcement of those easements moving forward. Otherwise, the lands are brought to a preferred state of enhancement or restoration, and then they're handed to DNR or stopped at that point.
Okay, and finally, Mr. Chair, just a comment.
Representative Miller.
I'll be done with, oh, I guess my time's up. Give me 15 extra seconds. I think that that's an important discussion that we need to have in the future, Mr. Chair, is understanding how many acres are going to be implied by what we're doing over the next, is it 25 years total? So, and how we are going to fund taking care of some of that land. Representative Torkelson had talked about some of the tax issues, but I think we also have some expense issues that we need to address sometime in the future also. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Ms. Koop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, if I may add, I mentioned the initial land reporting form earlier, and one of the pieces that I forgot to mention is a requirement under law for each applicant to submit, for each parcel of land acquired, future costs and operation of that land. And so submitted to both the council and to MMB is a document that attests to the anticipated cost for maintenance of those parcels. So those are on file. For the most part, agencies will include those maintenance activities in their budgets and are not anticipated to come back necessarily to the council for future maintenance funding.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank both of you, and we'll see you again.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having us.
And now, an overview from the Clean Water Council. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourselves, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Todd Renville. I hold the statewide hunting organization seat on the Clean Water Council, and I also participated in the Budget and Outcomes Committee.
Mr. Chair and representatives, good afternoon. My name is Barb Peichel, and I'm the Clean Water Council coordinator. And I'm going to take this opportunity to just go over the different handouts that are in your packet. First of all, is a copy of this presentation. There's also a one-page spreadsheet, which is the overview of the council's budget recommendations for the Clean Water Fund for FY16-17 by category. And by category, I mean, for example, a category would be all the programs that deal with water quality monitoring. There's also a multiple-page very colorful spreadsheet in your packet, and those are the council's Clean Water Fund recommendations by each program. And by program, I mean different programs at the agencies that receive clean water funds. In that larger spreadsheet, the fifth column is the council's recommendations, and there's also a column that shows the governor's recommendations for the Clean Water Fund. When those are different, they are highlighted in a very hot pink to kind of call your attention to them. There is also a notes column with some of the council's comments that Mr. Renville will go over. And I tried to, we tried to put in the presentation, if it refers to a certain page of the spreadsheet, we put that in the presentation too. There is also the council's report. This is due to the legislature on December 1st of every even number year. We know you're very busy, so there's also a one-pager that summarizes the report in your document. Note that the budget recommendations are also in the council's report, and then the progress on the Clean Water Fund is in Appendix A of the report. And again, the presentation may note a certain page of the report if you want to reference that for more information.
Mr. Chair and members, the Clean Water Council, it's composed of 28 members. 19 are governor appointed and voting members. I won't read down the list, but you can see them behind me here. There are also 5 commissioner appointed members representing agencies that have a stake in clean water issues, and 4 legislator appointed non-voting members, one of them being Representative Torkelson, who is a champion for clean water issues, both as a private citizen — he was a former member of our council — and now as a representative. The other representative that participates in our council is Representative Geruso, and then we have Senator Scalzi and Senator Osmick on the Senate side. I'll just provide a quick overview. Mr. Johnson covered a lot of the information that also pertains to the Clean Water Council in his presentation. Minnesota Statute 114D, the Clean Water Legacy Act, created the Clean Water Council in 2006. The Clean Water Council is, our charge is to advise on the administrative and implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act. We make recommendations to the governor and the legislature on how the Clean Water Fund should be appropriated. We started our process for developing our recommendations for appropriations about this time last year. It was a fairly extensive process. One of our first steps was applying lessons learned from past efforts and developing guiding principles and funding priorities to evaluate programs that were coming back to us for recommendations from funding from the agencies, but also to follow our charge of being a citizens committee that develops our own recommendations with input from others. 9 members served on the Budget and Outcomes Committee, met roughly 1 to 2 times a month. We developed draft recommendations that went to the full council. We reviewed program performance and asked the agencies that were coming to us with funding recommendations to not only describe past performance of the programs presented, but any new programs, try to project what sort of clean water outcomes might be involved with the additional work. And lastly, we reviewed the issue of substitute versus supplement. We also engaged stakeholders quite heavily. We had a public comment period in August of 2014, and then held a series of stakeholder meetings with representative groups that had a voice in the process. And of course, the agency interactions occurred throughout. Just a few examples of the guiding principles and funding priorities that we did develop. we really targeted promoted programs where funding will achieve significant new progress towards attaining the goal of clean water. One of the things we've struggled with as a council is that the legacy funding alone is not going to address all the water quality issues in the state. And as an outcome of our recommendation process, we really wanted to target those programs for funding that would achieve significant new progress and outcomes. One of our goals was to continue implementation of the state's watershed approach. And we've heard strongly from people on the ground implementing these programs that there's a need to supplement local capacity to support the non-point source implementation activities. And finally, another key item was identifying programs that leveraged other available funds.
Mr. Enville?
Mr. Chair.
The historian in me has to know. And how are you connected with the Renville County of Renville County? The Renvilles of Renville County?
Well, they're... I guess I can't prove a direct linkage, Mr. Chair. There is some discussion in my family that there's a connection to Joseph Renville. They were distant relatives. I haven't researched the genealogy back to prove or disprove that.
Get on Ancestry.com. Ms. Peichel?
Sure.
Okay. Chair and members, again, Minnesota Management and Budget just came out with a revised forecast for the Clean Water Fund for FY16-17. So that is that new total amount is $225.202 million. And you'll notice at the bottom line, because the council's report is due in December to the legislature, the bottom line that the council used was $221.6 million. So there's about a $3.6 million difference between those. So I just wanted to point that out.
So, Mr. Chair and members, the pie chart illustrates the groupings of or breakout of our funding recommendations. The biggest single allocation is related to on-the-ground projects that reduce non-point source pollution. That's 61% of our proposed budget. Moving around the pie chart, $7.8 million is proposed to technical expertise tools and conducting applied research. $23.5 million, or 11%, is proposed for developing watershed restoration and protection strategies. $24.1 million, or 11%, is monitoring and assessing surface water. And then the last category, $31.2 million, or 14%, is dedicated to drinking water and groundwater protection. And a key difference between clean water funds and what you just heard from Lasard Sams is that our funding goes towards programs, not necessarily individual projects. And those programs are administrated by agencies that they provide loans and grants to local governments, soil and water conservation districts, so on. So getting into the details of our budget, monitoring and assessment programs, this broad funding category addresses monitoring of surface waters in the state's watersheds on a 10-year schedule and includes monitoring of fish and plant communities, mercury levels, pesticides. Assessments determine if waters are impaired. By the end of this year, one of the outcomes of the work we've done so far, 75% of the 81 major watersheds will have been assessed. There are some differences in our recommendations from the governor's budget. We proposed more funding to support the MPCA's 10-year statewide watershed monitoring approach. And the increase is related to large river and sub-watershed monitoring. We have recommended no funding for the Minnesota Department of Health's Lake Superior Beach Monitoring Program. We felt it was not a statewide effort, and beach monitoring is funded locally at other regions. We recommended no funding for the MPCA's expanded contaminant of new concern effort. We felt there may be some duplication with other Department of Health programs. And as we work through those, as Barb mentioned at the beginning, you can follow along on the spreadsheet. There's a little note down in the corner. So moving on to the Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies Program, funding is proposed to develop plans that identify pollution reductions and actions needed to clean up impaired waters or protection actions for healthy waters. Comparing or contrasting with the governor's budget, we've proposed less funding for the MPCA's Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies Program. Most of this is related to cost of living increases proposed by the agencies. We reduced those to what we felt were more reasonable levels.
Representative Murphy, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a question about, would you repeat why you're not recommending the Lake Superior Beach Project? Program.
Mr. Renville.
Monitoring.
Mr. Chair and members, the Lake Superior Beach monitoring focuses on a very specific area. We felt that there were other beach monitoring programs in the state. They weren't receiving clean water funds. We understand that some of the requests came from federal funds initially that started the program that have since gone away, and it was just trying to prioritize on-the-ground implementation.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to remind monitoring program people that Lake Superior is the largest lake in the world with fresh water. And it has international, worldwide significance as well as local significance. I can't imagine that you would think that that was just like any other beach monitoring program.
Mr. Renville.
Mr. Chair and members, it's not minimizing the importance of Lake Superior. Our focus was to dedicate funds to on-the-ground projects. The drinking water and groundwater protection programs, funding is proposed to protect drinking water, monitor groundwater, and address failing septic systems. This particular category, the Minnesota Constitution requires 5% of our clean water funds be dedicated to this particular portion of the pie chart. And our council recommendations in this biennium include 12%. Differences between our recommendations and the governor's budget. We propose less funding for MPCA programs. Again, the cost of living issue. Less funding for the Department of Health's Contaminant Emerging Concerns Program. less funding for the Department of Health's well ceiling cost share program, and less funding for Met Council's demand reduction pilot and Department of Health's groundwater strategies for local implementation pilot. The non-point and point source implementation programs, again, the really the area of our focus, reflects a heightened priority for on-the-ground programs where funding will likely achieve maximum outcomes. Funds are used to implement pollution reduction activities such as upgrading wastewater infrastructure, restoring eroding stream banks, and implementing conservation tillage. Of the two pollution sources we mentioned, non-point is by far the most significant issue that we as a state have to grapple with. Pollution in this category comes from natural and man-made stream bank erosion, stormwater runoff from developed areas, and soil and crop management practices from agricultural areas. The point source contribution is regulated, well controlled, and very small in comparison to the non-point. Much of the funding in this category will address clear and present issues that have solutions with monitorable outcomes improving water quality. The difficulty is that the scope of the issue is very large. And as I mentioned earlier, the available resources are inadequate to the task. The council could have recommended a much larger, piece of the funding pie go to this category, since this is where the largest need exists. Differences between our recommendations and the governor's budget: more funding for Bowser pass-through funds, on-the-ground implementation projects with clean water quality outcomes. The unfunded need here is fairly high. One program in our portfolio only funded 25% of fiscal year 14-15 requests. Less funding for the Minnesota Water Quality Ag Certification Program. Less funding for MDA and DNR programs where outcomes are unclear. No funding for the Clean Water Partnership Program, and no funding for the MDA Vegetative Cover and Soil Health Program. Sure.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and members, I would just highlight that on page 4 of the spreadsheet that the council and the governor both recommend $1.5 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Program. So that is something that would help restore the St. Louis River, recognizing the importance of Lake Superior.
Under applied research and tool development, the funding is for technical expertise to local government units and landowners on hydrology, agriculture, and urban best management practices, groundwater geology, and water reuse. And a key point of this is it's a lot of this funding is used to target our implementation. Differences between the Clean Water Council recommendations and the governor's budget: more funding for the MDA's perennial and crop cover research, and MPCA stormwater BMP performance evaluation and technology transfer. No funding for the MPCA's wastewater treatment design and technical assistance program, and less funding for MDA's academic research evaluation program. Just a few notes about Clean Water Fund progress. As I mentioned earlier, monitoring assessment by December 2015, 75% of the state's watersheds will have been monitored. Drinking water under drinking water and groundwater protection, planning underway for groundwater management areas. Thousands of wells have been sampled for arsenic and nitrate. Hundreds of unused wells have been sealed. Under implementation, 15 lake and 20 river impairments have been restored to water quality standards. Projects reduced over 44,000 tons of sediment and prevented 48,000 pounds of phosphorus and 96,000 pounds of nitrogen from entering Minnesota waters. And projects reduced total phosphorus by more than 100,000 pounds per year from point sources. And finally, 4,900 failing septic systems have been replaced. The council also made a few policy recommendations in our annual report. The first is under riparian buffers, a topic that's generated a lot of discussion of late.
Mr. Renville, did the council take a position on the governor's 50-foot buffer proposal?
Mr. Chair and members, no, we haven't taken an official position on the governor's proposal. In our recommendations, there is a riparian buffer program that we've recommended funding. But at this point, we like everybody else, is waiting to see the details of the governor's proposal.
Mr. Renville, do you have any recommendations for how many feet a riparian buffer should be?
Well, Ms. Peichel probably has some insight into that, and I'll let her speak in a minute. But I guess the answer is it varies. You know, 50 feet has been thrown out as the average, but some areas probably could use more buffer, some less.
Mr. Chair and representatives, the council's recommendation, what they got to as a very diverse council, was that they recommended that the buffer width be based on conditions in the ground. And again, their recommendation came out in December of last year, so they have not responded. They're waiting to see the details of what the governor's proposal will be.
Thank you.
The other policy recommendation was water retention, storage, and infiltration. We passed several resolutions. The first is an endorsement of the One Watershed, One Plan framework for water resources planning. The second is we adopted Clean Water Fund guidelines for aquatic invasive species activities. The council was asked to clarify whether Clean Water Fund should be used for AIS, and we believe that yes, under certain circumstances, where the activities are prevention, but other multiple long-term funding sources are needed for a comprehensive AIS approach. There are several legislative bills that touch on the Clean Water Fund inflow and infiltration I&I reduction program. We as a council did not recommend funding of this. Not that we don't agree that it's an extremely important issue, but we believe that it should be statewide in scope and funded through the Public Facilities Authority. And then we thought there should be some limitations on Clean Water Funds not to be used on private infrastructure improvements unless it's for low-income landowners. And the Red River Watershed Management Board grant funding, the council did not recommend funding because it's not a statewide program, it wasn't directly related to our funding priorities. So that is the balance of my presentation.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? We have a couple of minutes. Well then, thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well then, as Sergeant Preston said to King, this case is closed.